Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and today we're talking with people who have found and are walking their own path in life, as we often do. We'll end today's hour with a tattooed independent culturist and writer who says that after years of addiction, he found himself literally on his knees, lost and broken. He set out to find a new path, one that went way beyond conventional religious or spiritual doctrine, and one that was free of BS. His new book is called Indie Spiritualist. We'll also hear from Barbara Bonner. She's a consultant and a board chair at the Barr Center for Buddhist Studies. She became inspired to write a book called Inspiring Generosity. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Helen Pepe to the show. She's an award-winning writer and photographer who began writing stories mostly about animals on scraps of butcher paper when she was knee-high to a horse. She's written a memoir described by reviewers as hilarious, dark, inspiring, poignant, depressing, uplifting, and courageous. Cy Montgomery, author of The Good, Good Pig, says it will break your heart and then heal it again. And the memoir is called Pigs Can't Swim. Helen Pepe, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
I'm very pleased to have you here. We were talking before we started about your fabulous photography, and I want to share that with our listeners before we go today. But let's look at the book, first of all. It is a memoir. It's based up until your teenage years. You grew up in the 70s, the youngest of nine children, a rural area. Tell us a little bit about what was so special about that time and why you wanted to write a book about it.
The thing that motivated me most to write a book about it is that a lot of people have really bad things happen in their childhood. But I think the important thing is to look past that and accept it and not let it claim you so that it ruins your whole life, and to find humor in it. And growing up where we did, it was as if we were on a different planet. We weren't connected to civilization in any way. I hadn't gone into a grocery store on my own until I was married. So wow. That wasn't until I was 18. And the first time that I did, I thought I was going to have a panic attack at the checkout. Even though my husband, Eric, had given me plenty of money, I still thought I couldn't possibly have enough, and that I was going to stand there and be so embarrassed. You know, it's just really people who don't understand living, you know, just so far away and so isolated can't understand that. But we really didn't go anywhere. My sisters and as well, you know, had the same types of fear. And I have a sister now who doesn't. She still doesn't have her driver's license. She still doesn't go anywhere.
Mm. Well, if you grow up so isolated, you really do not know anything else, do you? Because you're
Correct.
Not exposed to anything else.
Correct. You do not.
And I read that you were actually working on a memoir type book about weight loss and exercise, and
yes.
Somebody suggested to you, hey, maybe you should, you know, look back at your childhood a little and figure out why the weight issue. So talk to us about that, how that turned around.
Well, I was writing a book, and I'm still writing it, actually. It's called Naked, Finding My Feet. And that's when I went into an MFA program with this, so that I could, you know, learn about prose and narrative, because I'd up to that point just been doing journalism. And my first faculty mentor was Deborah Marcourt, who has written a memoir that is really wonderful. And so I sent her some stuff, and it had to do with food. And she wrote back to me and said, I really think that before you can continue on Naked, that you need to start exploring why you have these food issues in the first place. And as soon as I began to write, the first chapter actually that I wrote was The Killing House, and it was meant to be like just a short personal essay. But once I started writing, I couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, like a sump pump is how I compare it to. I just kept gushing out these stories. She read hundreds of pages for me in that 4-month time, and I wrote the whole thing in that amount of time.
Mm. So let's talk.
It's just amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. That's definitely what they call flow, right?
Yes.
Creative flow. And very cathartic, I'm sure, for you. And so cathartic that I heard you were actually writing a sequel to this.
I am writing a sequel to this. And at first I wasn't going to begin the sequel right where I left off, but so many people have asked me, well, what happened after you left? How did you manage to leave? What was it like that, you know, that first year? So I am starting it, you know, right directly where I left off.
Mm. And let's talk about the title, Pigs Can't Swim. That's a good title, but, and I understand it had, it did have something to do with a pig named Waterbra. Tell us about that.
Pigs can swim, as we all know, but the reason the title is Pigs Can't Swim is because even though my family saw Waterbra swimming across the lake to escape us, they insisted that he couldn't swim. And so the title sort of is a metaphor for how my family thinks. If they hear a myth, that myth stays with them forever, regardless of all evidence to the contrary.
You are very different in your family, one of 9 siblings, as we said, but you often felt isolated, not just by location, but within the family unit, which, you know, people think, well, you're surrounded by people, but it can be the loneliest form of isolation when you're actually with people and still feeling lonely. You were into books. Nobody else really was in your family. And you dreamt of just growing up being a writer and leaving home, which you eventually managed to do, of course. One of the questions that I had for you don't name your siblings in the book. You have unique yet names for them, like the blustery and favored brother, the hair-twirling pretty sister, and the sister who holds grudges longer than God. Why did you choose not to name them?
It was a very difficult decision in the beginning. And as you say, it is cathartic when you're first writing about all of your issues to get it all on paper. So that first 4 months where I got it all on paper, that was the cathartic part. Then I had to figure out a way to write it so that it would have shape, and, you know, and that was where the craft came in, so that it would be a thorough story of my growing up that other people could enjoy. When I first wrote it, I had to use all of my siblings' names because otherwise I felt great distance and mm-hmm. I couldn't feel them. So then the next step was I didn't want to use my siblings' real names because I didn't want anybody to know where this was taking place and who my family was. I wanted to protect them because this wasn't about them and it wasn't about revenge. You know, there's definitely no revenge in it at all. So at one point, I had sister 1, sister 2, sister 3. That was how I did it. But that didn't quite work either.
Right.
So I had, you know, I spent weeks trying to figure out how I would delineate each sibling, yet not have it be hugely cumbersome. And so, you know, at one point, I thought, well, I'll just give them different names. But when I gave them different names, that didn't work for me. I couldn't feel them in the text, and it all felt wrong, and it didn't feel right on my tongue. So instead, I chose names for them based on characteristics my parents would use when they talked about my siblings.
Mm.
So they would say that one of my sisters held grudges forever. They would always
right,
talk about
right.
her holding grudges.
Right. So have any of them read the book?
Yes.
And what kind of feedback have you had from them?
Very mixed. The sister who holds grudges longer than God has been the most supportive.
Oh,
and
well, that's good.
I know, because she does hold grudges. But because she holds grudges, she remembers everything. You know, those people who hang on to things, they're invaluable resource for information.
Right.
So right in the very beginning, I was calling her. Now, this is an important thing to remember. or to think about as people are reading Pigs Can't Swim, and I really regret I did not write this in the front. This sister who holds grudges longer than God was separated from my family. She hadn't spoken to any of us in 3 years. And that was based on a personal event in her life between her and my family. And we all missed her, and my mother missed her, but she would not come to any type of holiday event. She just refused to be part of it. So when I began writing Pigs Can't Swim, I sent her the first chapter, and I said, could you read this? I know you have such a good memory. Could you read this and tell me what you think? Well, she had been going to a therapist for many years because of her childhood and subsequent things that had happened to her as an adult. When she started reading the chapters, she began to come back to us. And first it was to me, then it was to my hair-twirling pretty sister, and they now have an amazing relationship. They're best friends, where they didn't, I mean, for 3 to 4 years, they never spoke.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it brought them together, and it brought my mother and father, you know, back to this sister. And so even though my parents were very, very upset about this book, they were supportive they're trying hard to be supportive of it now. They really are. And especially, you know, my father is working really hard to be supportive of it. And they feel very grateful that what it did do is to bring my sister back to them.
Right. Well, that's awesome. And I asked you if you would read a passage to our listeners, and I know you're prepared to do that. So
yes.
If you want to set that up for us, and then let me know when we come to the end.
Okay. Well, it begins, people should know that as a child, I was incredibly pesty, very nuisance-y to everybody. I asked lots of questions all the time. Nobody else in my family seemed to care about either questions or answers. And they were very willing to just go about their life doing their chores and not questioning anything. They just did it. But I had tons of questions, and I was always thinking. So I would follow my mother around or my father, just asking question after question, and I drove them crazy.
Well, you were quite a bit younger than the others, weren't you?
Yes,
yeah.
About 3 years between me and the next sister. So I was the last one, and you know, we had a small house, not very many bedrooms, only one bathroom. So it was very, in the winter, very small confines. So you have to picture when you have all these people mm-hmm. in the house and you have this one youngest, just constantly badgering people. I deserve their anger.
Okay. Okay, good.
So this is where it begins. It's about the question. Okay. Convinced of my imminent demise and considering all the hardened brown sugar lumps and chocolate chips I'd stolen when alone in the kitchen, I asked my mother, if I'm going to hell anyway, why does it matter if I steal? I swear you look for ways to be difficult, she answered, slamming the cupboard door on the baking chocolate. From the direction of the finger pointing me to my final destination during punishment, I knew that heaven was somewhere up and hell was somewhere down. But this baffled me because heat rises. If we sleep downstairs when it's too hot upstairs in the summer, I said to my mother, why is heaven up? She grabbed my shoulders in her two work-calloused hands to stare me square in the face, her eyes bloodshot from the strain of rarely answering, and said, stop asking so many questions. Why does Helen have to talk so much? My siblings complained. Unanimous in their disapproval and annoyance. She's such a dumb face. I wish she'd just shut up. I know, my mother agreed in a rare moment of commiseration with her daughters. Eventually, she'll get tired of it. But the questions only came faster as I grew, irritating my family and frustrating me. Did they think I was having fun asking questions no one answered? What does it sound like in the rooms when no one is home? What do animals think? Do they know they're going to die when they see the axe? Do they feel sorry for themselves? If we need to sleep to be healthy, why do you keep waking us up? Why do the coyotes howl at night? Do you think there's another planet like Earth somewhere? Does Margaret have to haunt our house? Why didn't she go to heaven or hell instead? What color is God? What color were Adam and Eve? If Eve's punishment is women suffering through childbirth, and if God is so merciful, how come he hasn't relented by now? If hell is below us, why don't people say you can dig to hell instead of China? Do you have to go through hell to get to China? I had asked in fourth grade, did you wonder where I was when you had only 8 children? And she had answered, no. In sixth grade, because she was always so angry with me and my teenage siblings, I asked why she had so many children, and she had told me, told all of us, that birth control methods had failed all 9 times. But the question I really wanted to ask, but never did, was, were you sad when you found out there was going to be yet another child? I didn't ask because I didn't want to hear the answer. And that's it.
I love listening to you read. We actually put the trailer on the on our Facebook page of you reading from your book, because I you have such a unique way of doing it. I can really picture it when you're reading.
Thank you.
How has writing this changed you, Helen?
How has writing the book changed me, or just writing?
Writing this book.
Well, writing it, first there was the cathartic part, but writing it really gave me a deep sense of empathy for my poor parents. You know, they had to put up with so much. It must have been crazy. So now when, you know, I look at my own children, who my daughter asked tons of questions as well, I am constantly thinking, oh, my poor mother, I must have driven her crazy. So,
well, you can imagine when she gets to number 9, right? It's like, oh, here we go again.
I know. And I only have 2 children, and they're 12 years apart. So it must have been really awful having so many young ones all at the same time. And it wasn't even that she had her 9. It's that they then went and got married and had kids of their own. So there were times where in our house we had, there were crowds in our tiny house. So it must have been extremely overwhelming for her. And, you know, I think when I get up in the mornings, I want to do my own thing, and I have it in my head. I want to sit down and write and do this. And then if my daughter gets up, or even if my dogs, you know, won't settle down, I will think of my mother and think, she had all these kids, all these animals. She never got to do anything she wanted. What were her dreams? What did she get up thinking she wanted to do in a day and have it be ruined? So writing Pigs Can't Swim has given me really a huge depth of empathy for her, as well as my father, who didn't and who regrets not being able to have spent time with his kids at all because he had to work.
Right. Well, we said earlier that your whole goal in life really was to escape the family and become an author, and you certainly succeeded in that. But you still live out in the main area, right? You're married to your childhood sweetheart, 2 children, as you said. So what do you think is next for you? And I do want to just talk about your photography before we go. So tell us what's next on your plate.
Well, next is to write the sequel to this book, and I did just finish a YA novel as well called I Name You Rockstar, which is about a 12-year-old girl who saves a horse with a 12-year-old boy, and that's a rescue horse. And I continue to do my photography. So I continue to write every day, and I photograph horses all over the place. I was in West Suffield, Connecticut, a few weeks ago, photographing Gypsy Cobs for Dungarvan Feather. I do a lot of work for them, as well as just, you know, private clients throughout Maine and New Hampshire.
And
that's
stunning.
A ton of fun.
It is stunning photography. And one of the things that struck me was how you really captured the essence of the horse, because they have great spirit. And you've really captured that. And you said that's your whole goal in doing this, really.
Yes, it's not to, like, there's this whole, you know, Photoshop art type of movement of where you change the backgrounds, you make them, you know, black or, you know, just put backdrops behind them to get out all the interference of, you know, fences and, you know, what it looks like at a horse farm. And horse farms, because there's so many horses, they're not beautiful when they're in the pasture. I mean, fences get chewed and, you know, they come up at all odd angles around the horse and the trees are bare and the ground is usually not grass because the horses eat the grass down to the roots. So, you know, it's often dirt paddocks. But I want people to feel the horse as they are. You know, they're in the pasture. I want them to feel the heat of the dust coming up from the paddock that they're feeling and experiencing. Mm. And if I take that away and try to make it just art, then I'm taking something away from the horse. And I want always for animals to be seen as they really are in their environment. That is my goal.
Your love of animals comes through. I know that on your farm when you were growing up, all of the animals were subject to be food at some point except the goats and the horses. And
Right. And
you chose to become vegetarian as a kid on that because you just were so in love with these animals. And that really does come across in your work. So what would you like listeners to know that I haven't asked you? What do you want them to take away from the book when they've read the book?
I guess I want them to take away that I want them, when they read the book, and some people miss this, and it's difficult because there's heavy subjects in the book, but I want them to see the humor in it and to see the compassion for the people around me as I'm growing up, and that as children, we can't find that empathy and compassion for the adults. As children, we really think about ourselves and our own experiences. So we have to go past that and mature. And so I want the readers to see that movement, you know, just of aging, that when we're kids, we see all of this and we're very self-centered and there's these tragic things that happen. But as we mature, we can look back and see something different.
Yeah.
Well, and find the humor in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there, you know, there is darkness in there, but it is very inspiring in other aspects. And it is laugh out loud in places. So I think you accomplished that, Helen. You should be proud.
Thank you. Some people do not find it funny, you know, because there's molestation in it and, you know, other instances of child abuse. And so I've gotten, you know, a few letters from people that say, I really didn't see the humor in this, but I'm very sorry, you know, about your childhood. I don't want people to feel sorry about my childhood. I want them to feel inspired to look back at their own childhoods and maybe see them a little differently and to laugh a little bit about things that happened instead of crying.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for being with us today, Helen Pepe. The book is Pigs Can't Swim. You can find out more about Helen at helenpepe.com, and Pepe is P-E-P-P-E. And check out her Facebook page, helen.pepe2, and check out that photography because it's stunning. But that they can link to that from your website anyway. Helen, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate
it. Well, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot.
And okay.
Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Barbara Bonner, who's written a book called Inspiring Generosity. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We will be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. B. BFN.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Next week on Conversations Live, we talk about standing up and facing major life transitions. Vicky's first guest, Nancy Sharp, shares how she and her husband stood up to cancer following his diagnosis while she was pregnant with twins. We'll also talk with two retired professors, now sprightly ladies in their 80s, who say turning 60 is a great thing if you stand up and enjoy life. Please join us every Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM and 98.9 HD Channel 3. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details and podcasts.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
The new mainstream of talk radio. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're talking in this segment about inspiring generosity with Barbara Bonner. Let me tell you a little bit about Barbara. She served in leadership positions in three New York City museums, as well as being vice president of Bennington College and the Crippler Center for Yoga and Health. She now has her own consulting practice focused on helping nonprofits transform their philanthropic support. And she's a board chair at the Bar Center for Buddhist Studies. And you can probably gather from that that she's committed her life to philanthropy. She's served on a total of 10 nonprofit boards and has started a fund to serve women with cancer in Western Massachusetts, where she currently lives. Barbara Bonner, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be with you.
And your book is called Inspiring Generosity. And let's just tell our listeners a little bit about the book. I would say it's more like a gift book. And I know that you write in the book that you'd like to see on coffee tables and given to gifts and given to inspire more generosity. So talk to us a little bit about it in your own words, if you would.
Well, you're exactly right. My hope all along was that it would be a gift book, actually that people would buy one copy for themselves and then to give one copy to somebody in their life who has been particularly generous and has really made a difference to them. And that's what I'm hearing is happening. This book has been out for 2 weeks, but it seems to be true. Mm. You know, I've worked in philanthropy, as you say, all my life, and as I started really diving into the subject of generosity, as I began the book, I found that there is often quite a difference between the two subjects. Generosity can be an entirely different matter from philanthropy. Philanthropy can come from a number of different motivations, you know, to feel important, to feel acknowledged, and generosity really comes from a sort of an inner fire, I think, to try and help, to make a difference in the world, to step forward where we see some pressing need in our lives and commit to doing what we can to help.
Mm.
So I was interested in that and then into diving into wonderful, wonderful stories of people for whom generosity just sort of arrived in a lightning bolt in their lives.
Right. I want to take a look at a couple of those stories in a moment.
Great.
But you say in the book, you know, we are a generous nation, but it's worth remembering that 97 million Americans live in poverty today. And in our world, 10 million children under the age of 5 die every year, which comes out, and that's as a direct result of poverty.
Right.
That comes out to 27,000 every day.
Astonishing figure, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it really takes your breath away.
So the book, as you said, is you share stories in here. And one of my favorites we just talked about was a lady named Mary Donnelly. Tell us a little bit about Mary's story and why you chose to include that in the book.
Well, Mary's amazing. She's 83 years old. She's become something of a legend. She's lived on Block Island, which is a little island off the coast of Rhode Island, for 55 years. She's the longest working employee of the state of Rhode Island, and she's been responsible for the health care of the 1,000 people who live on the island for these 55 years without any doctor. Health care is usually delivered by house calls. And over the years, she just has a very big heart, and she's responded to the incredible economic needs of this island, which is largely dependent upon tourists and wealthy second homeowners. And when they vanish after Labor Day, unemployment skyrockets, and often people are really left quite stranded economically. So she started a fund, which everyone calls the Mary D. Fund. She gives away about $50,000 a year. She has two stipulations. You have to be a full-time resident of the island, and she has to pay the bills herself so that, as she says, you're spared the poor people's pub. In other words, the money really goes where it needs to go.
Right, right.
And she's helped over 30% of the people on the island. It's a wonderful story, somebody who's really devoted so much of her life to being so selfless. And like all the 14 stories in the book, Mary, I end the story by saying Mary's quote, "I'm an ordinary person who's been gifted with this." Mm. All of the heroes in my book really think that they're doing nothing particularly noteworthy or virtuous. They're just living their lives and making a real difference doing it.
Yeah, there was a quote in the book that I really liked. That's what I consider true generosity. You give your all, and yet you always feel as if it costs you nothing. How did you select the people? How did you come about them? How did you find them that you included in the book?
Well, you know, as with anything in life, once we start to focus on it, it sort of comes at us. So once I really became struck by the first few stories of people whose lives were just turned around by generosity, and I don't mean by receiving generosity, I mean by becoming extremely generous, stories sort of started pouring in the window, the computer, and I really collected hundreds of them and then boiled them down to the 14 I use in the book. I think the thing that they have in common is that all of these people were going about their regular lives. They weren't looking for an inspiration, but it came swooping in on them. And they had sort of a moment of real recognition, what I call a lightning bolt of generosity. And their lives changed utterly. And inspiration has always been fascinating to me. You know, mm-hmm, we can't make it happen. and so to have these 14 lives that were really transformed were the ones that I wanted to use.
And it's sometimes very surprising where we do find inspiration, sometimes in the places we least expect. I'm wondering if you have a favorite story in the book.
Oh, well, I have so many. That's really like asking you amongst your children.
Is that unfair? Authors often say that when I ask them that. But
is that true? Well, I do. I am sort of partial to the first one. Maybe that's why it's first in the book. A wonderful man named Sasha Dichter, who works in New York, actually in philanthropy, was coming home on this commuter train one evening, and a beggar came onto the train. New Yorkers are very used to that, asking for money for the homeless. And, of course, in New York, everyone then looks down at the floor or looks away,
right.
And as did Sasha. And then his lightning bolt moment when he stepped off the train and he realized, I just want to stop saying no. No can be who I am. I want a new way of being in the world. And so he invented for himself the practice of simply saying yes for the month of December to everyone,
mm-hmm.
to beggars and mail solicitations and street musicians. And he said, as all the people in the book do, At the end of the month, he realized it wasn't about the money. It was about standing in a new place in his life. It really changed him.
Yeah.
And they all have that experience.
Yes, and I'm so glad you actually chose to share that story with us, because that was another of my favorites. And it goes to the point you made about philanthropy being different to generosity. They're not necessarily the same thing. And he said he saw just how deeply people are hungering for something more in their lives, more connection and more meaning. Generosity is a beautiful path on that choice. Barbara Bonner, this is a really lovely book, and I thank you for being with us today. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think that generosity is all around us. That really is the point of the book. We just need to open our eyes and our hearts to it, and we're in for a wonderful surprise when it touches us so deeply.
And let listeners know where they can find out more about you.
Well, the book itself has a website at inspiringgenerosity.net, and that has information about me, but also some wonderful blurbs and endorsements, things that people have already said about this book this week. Just this week, President Clinton wrote a beautiful letter about it. So it's been received just so wonderfully. I can hardly believe it, but you can read all about that on the website.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for being with us today. The book, again, is called Inspiring Generosity by Barbara Bonner. Makes a lovely gift book, but, you know, buy a copy for yourself, too. But generosity begins with ourselves, right?
It does indeed.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Barbara. Appreciate your time.
A pleasure.
And please do stay with us. We'll take a quick break. We'll be coming back with the Indie Spiritualist. And this is an interesting story, too. So please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Wondering what went wrong, lying down on your knees, asking for sympathy.
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE, or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Jana Rosewood, author of Are You Still Kissing Frogs?, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 9th, we'll spring forward with Entertaining the Human Animal. Gifted channel Greg Bertoli will join us in the studio again. Through him, we'll talk with founding father and the inventor of daylight savings time, Benjamin Franklin. We had a lot of fun last time, so plan to join us and give us a call if you've got a question for Ben. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Radio for your body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm going to bring Eric on, our fabulous producer here, of course, who's with us every week, keeping us live. And he found, he just played us in with some of our next guest's music, Chris Grosso. So tell us a little bit about that, what that was.
Oh, it's just a piece by Alana Kaivalya. Hopefully I said that name correctly. And Chris Grosso, and I believe that's called In the Sun. So Chris can tell us more about the music as we bring him on.
Okay, well, let me give Chris a proper introduction here. Chris Grosso, he is an independent culturist, spiritualist, aspirant, recovering addict, professor with Entheos Academy, and author of Indie Spiritualist, a no BS exploration of spirituality. He writes for Huffington Post, Rebel Society, Origin Magazine, and Mantra Yoga Plus Health Magazine. He's a self-taught musician. He's been writing, recording, and touring since the mid-90s, and he's written a new book called The Indie Spiritualist, a No BS Exploration of Spirituality. Chris Grosso, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be here with you today.
Well, tell us a little bit about that piece of music we just listened to as we brought you into the segment here.
Yeah, sure. As Eric had said, that's a piece I do in a two-piece kirtan band with my fellow friend and author and musician, Alana Kaivalya. She's a brilliant yoga teacher, and she actually has her second book coming out soon with New World Library called Sacred Sound. And Alana is just a dear friend that I met a few years ago in New York City. We instantaneously hit it off like we'd known each other forever. And she's a beautiful singer. She plays the harmonium. I play drums as well as some other instruments. And actually, it was funny. During our first meeting for lunch, she was telling me she was performing out at Yoga Journal conference in Estes Park, Colorado. This was in 2012. And her friend had just kind of fallen through on her, and she asked me if I wanted to come out there and play drums. So I was like, yeah, okay, why not? And so we wrote a few songs, and we performed out there, and we've been kind of doing that off and on ever since. And it's just a real treat to not only be able to perform kirtan, but to be, you know, doing it with someone that is so dear to me. So that's a little bit about it.
Yeah, good story there. And today's whole show is about people who really have, not necessarily taken a traditional path and just, gone on their own journey. And you certainly have done that. And with your book, you describe it as a guidebook for today's generation of spiritual misfits who crave a dogma-free path. So tell us a little bit, Chris, about where you were in life when you say you were literally brought to your knees, lost and broken.
My knees, my back passed out. I mean, I'm, like you said, I'm a recovering addict. So I came into recovery about 10 years ago, but unfortunately, I had suffered a couple of relapses in that time. And in 2011, I suffered a terrible, terrible relapse that did bring me, to quite literally to the edge of death. And I woke up in a jail cell. It was from a blackout drunk. It was a really, really, really bad, dark time for me then. But I went to detox the next morning, and then proceeded to leave the state. I live in Connecticut, so I went to New Jersey for a couple of months and actually went into an inpatient rehab program. It wasn't my first time doing these things, but something clicked while there that hasn't clicked for me in the past. And I'm giving you the very abridged version. I came home from there with a real complete surrender, to trying to do things of my own accord. And each day since then, I wake up and the one prayer I say every morning is I just ask, the higher power of my understanding to help me set myself aside so I can be of service, and allow a greater good to be, done through me, and so I can help as many people as possible, which has subsequently aligned all the right people in my life. And here I am just shy of 3 years after waking up in that jail cell with a book coming out. So it's kind of crazy to me, to be honest.
It's strange how that happens when we start working toward things. Yeah, and yet you say in the book, I still have trouble considering myself a writer, but you've often written, and you have a chapter called Detox Diaries, that you kept through in detox. And occasionally you said you'll sift through those pages to remind myself how I used to live, as a sobering reminder that I can end up right back there. Best scenario, if I don't keep myself in check. Is it difficult to go back and read those? I'm assuming it is.
Oh, it's gut-wrenching, but not you know, strictly in a negative sense. You know, I'm actually looking over my corner, and I could see a box full of those journals. And, I definitely don't consider myself a writer. And I say that because I have friends who really are an artist when it comes to writing. You know, they're very much a master of the craft. And I'm a fan of people like Voltaire or Hunter Thompson, Charles Bukowski, you know, people that I consider real writers. For me, I feel like I'm more of an experience sharer. You know, I write from the heart. I write candidly. So that's what I mean by, you know, having trouble really considering myself a writer. I didn't go to school for writing. I had never had any intention of writing a book. It was just during these dark times I would keep these journals. I'm creative by nature, whether it's music or whatever. I just need to be creating. So even when in these dark places, inebriated places, I would still write. So I wanted to share a little of that experience with the reader to help them really get a glimpse inside the mind of what happens to some people when they're in those dark places.
Right.
So to revisit those journals for the purpose of the book, it's tough. And yes, once in a while I do go back just because it keeps it green for me. You know, like I said, best case scenario, I'm ending back up in an emergency room in a jail cell. That's the best case scenario for me if I pick up again. So.
Well, I think you've been very honest. And one of the blurbs that I read about your book says, brutally honest, bitingly humorous, which it is, and radically unconventional. Your story of your collection of vignettes shows what it means to live an authentic, open, and mindful life. Indie Spiritualist, your website and your book, is all about accepting yourself as you are in all your humanity and imperfect perfection. And I read in the book how you really didn't like yourself at all at one point, and you didn't think you stood out in any way, and getting tattoos was one way that kind of satiated that for a while for you, but then you started cutting yourself. I mean, you've really been through it. At what point did you say, you know, this has got to stop and we've just got to move forward in a spiritual? I mean, why choose a spiritual path, I guess, is what I'm asking there.
Oh, sure. So, I mean, I actually didn't choose the spiritual path. It was, you know, it was kind of like laid upon me in a strange way. It was in 2004, or maybe early 2005, right around there. I was about a year sober for my first time, you know, ever, after coming out of a detox and a rehab. And I got in school for substance abuse counseling because I wanted to try and help others who are struggling from this as well. And I started to go through a dark time, not a relapse time, but a heavy time, breakup with my girlfriend, et cetera. And I was really close with a professor in my class who gave me Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now. And that was, you know, quite literally like having the rug pulled out from under me. You know, something as simple as reading for the first time, I am not the incessant thought stream, you know, that's happening in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually more than just this material, physical body. I mean, that's part of it too, but there's more happening. And so from there, just engulfing myself in, you know, the books of people like Ram Dass and Ramana Maharshi, Ken Wilber, Thich Nhat Hanh, Pema Chodron, and on and on and on. However, that wasn't enough, you know, to keep me sober. I was basing my sense of wellness on the material aspect. Even though I was learning these things, it takes time, you know, really to cultivate that understanding and, most importantly, the experience of what you're reading. So I was basing my sense of wellness on getting the car back, getting the job back, having a girlfriend. However, I wasn't doing any sincere internal work. I was reading, and what I was reading was resonating, and I would meditate a bit, but it really just wasn't. The experience wasn't quite happening for me yet, which subsequently it finally started to later on. So,
and I'm glad you mentioned The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle, because one of the things there I got marked here in the book is that you said an aspect that really stuck out to me while reading The Power of Now was the universal teaching style, incorporating many different forms, because I think so many people get locked into, oh, I just read this book by, you know, XYZ, and they said ABC, and this is it. And right. we have to find what's true for ourselves. And that's what I really like about your work and the videos I saw is you are in that search for yourself, and you certainly don't claim to have all the answers, and it is a continuing journey.
Right. Yeah, and that's been very important for me since I was a teenager, well before I had any interest in spirituality. I've just always been very eclectic by nature, and I went to a high school where it was like you either like heavy metal or you liked rap music, you know, and I loved both. You know, it's just how I've always been, and as I've grown older, I can watch a comedy one day, a horror movie the next, and have an appreciation for both, and a spiritual documentary thrown in the mix, and that's just who I am, you know, and so that's how it translated with spiritual teachings for me. I have plenty of friends that are consider themselves Christian or Buddhist, you know, and so on, and that's wonderful. Whatever resonates, God bless. You know, I hope you're happy and you're becoming independently wise and compassionate and just finding that self-love and all the good things for yourself. But for me, it's important to be able to draw from different traditions, and that's just how I am by nature, and I think that's how a lot of the younger generation of truth seekers are as well. They're eclectic. They like to have a little variety, and that's part of what I certainly kept in mind while writing this book.
Right, right. One of your interviews on video, you said, or Skype, however you did that, you asked Ram Dass, he wrote, "The path of the heart is not easy, and it takes time and intention." And you asked him what he would say today to the person he was in the 70s, or is it all grist for the mill, you asked him. What was his response to that?
Boy, I have not watched that video in, boy, since pretty much we did it. I'm trying to recall. Let me tell you quick about that experience, and because I honestly don't recall the exact.
Right. I'm not expecting you to remember the exact words because he basically said, you know, it's I am who I am today. That was his response, really.
That sounds about right. So what I can share about that, though, is, people are asking me that day or after the following weeks, even to this day, like, what was it like, you know, interviewing Ram Dass? And it was crazy to me because for that 45 minutes to an hour I was with him, when it was done, I literally didn't remember the interview. It was just like such a surreal experience. I felt so elated, and I don't mean to over-romanticize the experience, but this is exactly how it happened for me. I really didn't remember basically anything I said to him. I didn't remember much of what he said to me. I was just really shocked by the whole thing because he's been such an important teacher in my life. So to be able to share that space with him, even though it wasn't in person, but at least via Skype, it was just a tremendous, tremendous experience. And then be able to write about that a bit in the book and share that interview, very meaningful.
Yeah. So we're almost at the end of our segment, Chris. Tell me what you want listeners to know about this book and your reflections in this book and where you are right now.
Sure. I believe the book is absolutely accessible for anyone who is interested in spirituality, addiction recovery, the independent arts, music, film, literature, of any age. You know, I did write it a bit with the younger generation of truth seekers in mind. I kind of used my 24-year-old self as a template when I was first stumbling onto the spiritual path. And I really wanted to offer a book that that gives the reader a sense of, it's okay, come as you are onto the spiritual path. It doesn't need to look a certain way. It doesn't need to sound a certain way. It's really about finding what works for you, having your own experiences. If you're struggling with dark times, I offer, you know, very candidly my experience to show people that no matter how dark it got, hope is always there, and you always can pull yourself out. So there is a lot going on in the book. It's not just a book about one thing from start to finish. But it's been really cool to read the reviews and the endorsements to see through others' eyes and others' words what they took away from the book. And it just really emphasizes to me or reiterates that it's a book that I think really is applicable for a lot of people.
Yeah,
so.
I would agree. And it's a fresh perspective. And I do think you're very honest in here, and it's also funny in parts too. So we all need a little light relief along the way, you know.
Couldn't agree more with that, for sure.
Well, Chris Grasso, I thank you so much for being with us. The book is called Indie Spiritualist, a no BS exploration of spirituality, and we're having to adapt to the title because I can't say the real word on air there. But Indie Spiritualist, and the website is theindiespiritualist.com if you want to find out more about Chris and his music and his work in general. Chris Grasso, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
And please join us next week. We'll be back with an all-live new show next week. Meanwhile, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net or 800-495-7617. If you had feedback on today's show or questions, 800-495-7617. We'll see you next week. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.